This is the second day of this January 2013 Rohatsu 7-day session. And we'll return to our text from yesterday. The book is called Zibo, the last great Zen master of China. It's translated by J.C. Cleary. Yesterday we covered the biographical information that we have about him. He lived in the 16th century. Now we'll just go right into his teachings. The first one is called, I'm not going to read the little subtitles that the translator chose to give these things, because sometimes I think they're just arbitrary. We'll just go right into this. When the sharp sword comes out of its case, the rays of light flash in the sun. It cuts through iron as if it were clay. Whatever kind of wood is cut and carved by, it is sure to become a vessel. This is good use of the sword. Sword, in this case, is awareness. Awareness is a pretty good way of understanding Buddha mind. It's a mind of awareness. And it's something no one is without. To be sentient means to have awareness. It's what all creatures equally have. Not the same level of consciousness, but still awareness. Possibly we could also understand the sword as a sword of discriminating wisdom. But I think awareness is better, as we see in what follows here. Though the sword is sharp, there's a certain kind of fool who only uses it to cut mud. No vessel is formed of the mud, and the sword blade is progressively ruined. This is bad use of the sword. And then he explains some. This is like the basic subtle wonder inherent in the minds of living beings. They do not use concentration and wisdom to contemplate it, but just indulge in clinging to objects, running after sensory experience without turning back, flowing on through birth and death, illusion and suffering ever deeper with no escape. How could this be good use of mind? Another, besides awareness, we could understand the sword as a sort of concentration that we use when we're doing zazen, cutting away thoughts, which really just means detaching from thoughts. We don't have to do anything to the thoughts. The thoughts will just settle on their own. The thoughts are not where our work is. Our work is with the breath, with the koan, whatever our practice is. When we're absorbed in our practice, this is good use of the sword of our basic intelligence, intelligence with a capital I. This reference to concentration and wisdom, this is the two sides of awareness or meditation. In Buddhism, there's the side, the concentration side is that which where we are able to hold the mind, the attention, steadily on one object of mind. Like mu, let's say, just concentrating on one thing at a time. That's the concentration. The wisdom is the complement to the concentration. The wisdom is the you could say, is the insight. Concentration by itself it doesn't have the power to bring us to awakening. Concentration gets us to the threshold of awakening. But many people have in this world have tremendous concentration, but misuse it. In other words, it's many people find something, some activity or some thing or some person into which they can become absorbed. Obsessed would be an extreme version of this. That's a kind of concentration, a focus. Millions of people have a tremendous ability to be focused on acquiring wealth. This is not with wisdom. The wisdom element is missing there. People have ability to lose themselves in internet stuff, pornography, and all kinds of political craziness, and time can pass so quickly. They just lose awareness, self-awareness. This, I believe, is one of the what makes the internet so addictive for some people is this, the relief of getting beyond oneself in absorption in the material that we see in the internet. There's something very basic need we have as human beings to find this way of forgetting the self, forgetting this pesky observing critical mind, and there's just no end of activities that we can find to do this, to get beyond ourselves. It's really a form of self-transcendence, but it's just temporary. I mean, drugs is another thing. Drugs can enable us to lose ourselves. I'm thinking of pot especially, to get completely absorbed in the brownie or whatever it is we're doing. There's so many maladaptive ways that are available to us for losing ourselves. But these things are without the element of reflection or contemplation, of awareness, actually, mindfulness. We can become so thoroughly absorbed in things without the element of mindfulness. That's sort of the wisdom part of it. And so he says, they do not use concentration and wisdom to contemplate it, that is, to turn the mind back and see into with insight, but just indulge in clinging to objects, running after sensory experience without turning back. Turning back meaning without reflection. We can find ourselves in these states in Sesshin. People can get lost in certain food fantasies or sex fantasies or other things. Flowing on through birth and death, illusion and suffering ever deeper, with no escape. How could this be good use of mind? Ironically, this ability to glue the mind, for the mind to get glued to something, gets stronger as Sesshin goes on. And that's where it becomes really obvious that the dual nature of mind is that we have the greater ability to merge with the breath or the koan, but at the same time, we can more easily get stuck in a thought or a fantasy. It's like Velcro. It can be very sobering, even a little disheartening late in Sesshin when we've been able to get more and more concentrated on the practice, to suddenly see that concentration find a different object, someone, fixing on someone, either in Sesshin or someone outside Sesshin, someone at our workplace, someone in our family. And we can find it very difficult to swing the attention back to the practice. I think that's very much what he's talking about here. Same thing with any kind of pleasure, anything we find pleasurable, reading novels. This is a form of escape for many people. It's where you get so lost in a story that hours can go by, and where you're just transported. But it is just a temporary state of absorption, and nothing that really develops mindfulness, awareness, much less awakening. He goes on, those of sharp faculties and superior wisdom use the light of the mind's inherent nature to shine through sense faculties and sense objects to reveal that both lack reality nature. Reality nature. That's the translator's choice to render whatever it was as reality nature. What he's saying is that the sense faculties are seeing or hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, and the objects of the senses both lack any abiding nature, any abiding reality to them. They are in flux. They're fundamentally empty. This is what he means by lack reality nature. They come and they go. In other words, to put it in the simplest terms, when a bell is struck, we hear it, and then, sooner or later, it disappears, the sound. Same with all the senses. And the same, luckily, the same with our desires. These cravings that we can get caught in when we're doing hours a day of meditation, these too have a way of just running their course. If we give them half a chance to do so, if we are aware of these states of craving and notice them, and then use the practice that we are working on to withdraw our attention from those states of craving. When the work of concentration and wisdom is achieved, right within sensory affliction, they find liberation. Right within emotional consciousness, they reach the light of wisdom. So we are never really, we can never be estranged from this true nature of ours, even when we are caught in sensory attachments and other attachments. Ultimately, he's speaking in the ultimate sense, these are not apart from our luminous self nature. The image, the classic image in Buddhism is the lotus. The lotus grows out of the mud. They say the mud of our defilements, our blind passions, but it emerges. A lotus literally will emerge from the mud absolutely unstained, just perfectly clean. And this is the possibility we have of freeing ourselves from our binding attachments to sense pleasures and thoughts and everything else. And then he says, if you use the sword like this, you are bound to cut through diamonds and jade. All the vessels formed will be strong, complete, and imperishable, filled with sweet dew to offer libations to all. We've heard him mention a couple times here, vessels, right in the beginning. He said, whatever kind of wood is cut and carved by, it is sure to become a vessel. The significance of a vessel being something useful, something that can provide, something in which we can give to others. Whoever is touched by a drop will have his burning vexations become pure and cool. He will find immeasurable hundreds of thousands of samadhis. None comes from outside because all are inherent in the nature of mind. So the very same capacity we have to become addicted to things or just attached to things is the same thing that enables us to reach samadhi. Single-minded focus, absorption to the point of self-forgetfulness. This is what is the great, great privilege of encountering the Dharma, is we have a method, we have a way to transform our blind passions, our cravings, into samadhi, which is the way of liberation. Then he says, thus it is said, for one who makes good use of mind, the 84,000 afflictions are 84,000 samadhis. For one who makes bad use of mind, the 84,000 samadhis are 84,000 afflictions. Ah, the sword is basically no different. With good use, every cut is accomplished. With bad use, day by day, the sword goes to ruin. So misusing this tremendous resource we have called awareness or attention. Where are we placing our attention? That decides everything. In terms of our bondage to worldly things or our freedom from them. Where are we placing our attention? Where are we directing our attention? We have a choice. And then finally he says, there is true light and there is false light. The true shines through 10,000 ages without relativity. The false is the light emitted when glued to the six sense objects. The sixth being the object of thought. This in Buddhism is counted as the sixth sense. And certainly we do have this is as powerful an addiction as any, this addiction to our thoughts. With our annual Sangha entertainment coming up next month, I think, I'm reminded of stories I've heard of people in Sesshin getting waylaid by thoughts about skits for Sangha entertainment. What a waste of time. What a waste of Sesshin to be dwelling in ideas about scripts for Sangha entertainment. It's pathetic. But the opportunity we have of using this mind to come to liberation and getting bogged down in comical scenarios and other stuff. Okay, these things can come up, of course, anything can come up in Sesshin, but we've got a choice. Is that how you want to spend your Sesshin, dwelling in that kind of stuff? What makes it so tempting is because, again, the concentration that's available to us when we're sitting 10 or more hours a day means that we can create all kinds of wonderful things. But it's such a misuse of the potential of Zazen. Here's another talk, I guess, of his. Reality nature is like water. Feelings are like ice. Okay, so here he's comparing our true mind unshackled from the binding effects of our attachments. He's comparing that to feelings. And feelings here really means feelings based on self and other, the delusion of a separate self and standing apart from other. Feelings of feeling cold is that is the functioning of our true nature. Feeling pain, that's also the same. But he's talking more about feelings of fear, anxiety, or anger, and so forth. These also are part of our true nature, of course, but they can really hinder us if we give way to them. So reality and nature is like water. Feelings are like ice. Ice is a solid obstruction. Water is fluid and flows through. Free-flowing, it is fundamentally without subject and object. There is knowing these meanings, and there is awakening to these meanings. With knowing, the ideas are understood, but in contact with things and events, there is still delusion. Someone in Doksan, the Sesshin, mentioned that she had brought with her into Sesshin some trailing vines from an encounter that she had had with someone before Sesshin, and how that was getting in her way, in her zazen. Nothing that wouldn't pass sooner or later, but what she said was, I somehow, and she kind of smiled when she said this, somehow I imagine that I'm going to be able to resolve that little friction I had with that person. I'm going to be able to resolve it by thinking about it. And I really didn't have to point out, because clearly she already understood that that's not the way to resolve something like that. You resolve it through losing yourself so completely in your practice that the concern about it, the attachment to it, the thoughts disappear. This is, Zen offers us a radically different way of resolving problems. It's not by problem solving as we think of that, of just analyzing and sorting through it and reworking it in the mind and thinking about what we could have said or should have said, would have said, da 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 da. In other words, trafficking in thoughts about the thing, it may help maybe in the future that we may not make the same mistake, but what's already happened, the way to resolve it is to leave it behind. It's in thinking about it that it's a problem. When there are no thoughts about it, where's the problem? So the premise of Buddhist meditation, certainly Zen practice, is that we create problems in our thoughts. Without thoughts, there are no problems. It's not clinging to, certainly not clinging to something that has already happened and we can't change. That's just stupid to do that. You know, and there are practical things. Okay, maybe, you know, after Sesshin I can say something, apologize or whatever. Yeah, but okay, let that go. Just now, we're in Sesshin. Can you just lose yourself in your practice? And spare yourself the misery that you create by dwelling in your thoughts about what has already happened and done with. We think of masochism as this really neurotic kind of thing, but really, don't we all have masochistic tendencies if we are willingly choose to sit and dwell in thoughts that are painful? That's masochistic. You're creating unnecessary pain for yourself when you're doing that. So he's comparing here getting it intellectually, what I just laid out about masochism, okay, it's perfectly rational. Anyone can understand it on a rational level. But then there's really getting it, understanding it to the point where we change our behavior. So he says, with knowing, the ideas are understood, but in contact with things and events, there is still delusion. Out of habit, we continue to react. We continue to chew on things mentally when it serves no purpose. Well, we all know this. With awakening, in contact with things and events, you understand their inner truth, that sentiments and sense objects are of themselves empty. Notice, he's not saying they're bad to experience anger or any other emotion. It's just that they're empty. They have no substantiality to them. That's what gets us in trouble. Delusion is the entanglement of feelings. Awakening is meshing with reality. A reality here means what is beyond feelings. Or what, when the feeling passes, what's there? Entanglement means duality. Meshing means oneness. Duality implies relativity. In other words, two-ness, subject and object, self and other. Oneness implies birthlessness. Birthlessness is the constant principle of reality. Relativity is the transformation of reality. Constancy is selfless and luminous. Transformation means having sentiments and being dimmed. Constancy, one way to understand constancy is the sky behind the clouds, the blue sky, which may be obscured by clouds, but nonetheless is always there. This is the changeless aspect of our true mind. And then there are the clouds that come and go, that are moving here and there. This is the change aspect of the mind. And that's what gets us into trouble when we haven't seen the sky behind it. Or when we haven't seen that part of the sky, even when it's completely, when the sky is completely obscured by clouds, there is still this other side, this clear, bright, blue sky that is always there. We don't see it much in Rochester, but it's there. My sister Sonia loves to tell about when one of her kids was still young enough to be on her hip. He was a baby, the boy. And it had been one of these long, dark, cloudy Decembers. And she said one day the sun broke through the clouds and Brett looked up with his little, put his little index finger up and said, "What's that?" The next entry, he begins, "Even an utter fool would fear being burned or scalded if we sent him into boiling water or fire. Even under compulsion, he would not agree to go into boiling water or fire." And, you know, he's leading into a metaphor here. "The boiling water and fire of the five desires burn and scald the life of wisdom of the body of reality of living beings. Yet people willingly walk into them, and not for a morning or an evening only. To the end, they never fear them." Let's just say what these five desires are that he's referring to. We have a footnote here of two ways of understanding them. The five desires can be construed as desires for the five sense objects. So sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch. Or, alternatively, the five desires are these: the desire for wealth, desire for sexual pleasure, desire for food and drink, the desire for fame, and the desire for sleep. So, of course, the principle here behind this little talk of his is that when we become attached to our desires, that's when we end up being harmed by them. That having a desire is one thing. They come and they go. They have a mind of their own, these desires for these things. But when we stick ourselves to them, when we cling to these desires, we're just creating suffering for ourselves, just starting with ourselves. Anyone who's practiced in Buddhism for long understands the basic doctrine here that he's laying out. But he says it with such conviction, the knowing that comes from truly having seen the suffering coiled in our attachments to our pleasures. To the end, they never fear them, he says. Have they lost their minds or gone mad? Overall, they judge the stinking bag of skin to be a vessel of purity and judge the mind of ignorance to be the root of life. It's because they cannot contemplate the body in terms of the four elements, or the mind in terms of the four clusters. I don't want to get into that right now. Modern people cannot sleep if the pillow is the least bit uncomfortable. When they lie down in bed, they are sure to make it comfortable before it will do. Birth and death is indeed important to people, yet they all ostensibly rest content and unconcerned and don't plan for it in the least. Why? Nine out of ten of you who hear this, or maybe more, 49 out of 50 people hear this, just goes in one ear and out the other. Right, yeah, okay, yeah, attachment to desire is going to cause me misery someday, but then it's gone. Because of the force of habit, because of the force of craving, we continually are drawn to these things that just build up attachments and cause suffering for us. Here he's talking about suffering as a teacher. For those whose natural potential is crude and rough, the Buddha's words are an obstruction. For those whose natural potential is deep, even when many sufferings crowd around them, they see them all as teachers. Hence the saying, use the mind well, and everywhere you touch is a basis for enlightenment. Don't use the mind well, and everywhere is obstruction. He goes on, before the primordial Buddha, before the Buddhas arose, there was no ground for the causal basis of enlightenment. Ultimately, who is the teacher of the primordial Buddha? In other words, he's talking about this realm that is beyond causation. This causes that, or this changes into that. That's what he means by the primordial Buddha, our intrinsic Buddha nature, unscored by thoughts and divisions into this and that, before and after. He says, little do you realize that suffering was the teacher. So he's comparing, he said, before there was any Buddha or enlightened one to be a teacher, there was suffering. As for the primordial Buddha, even though his natural potential was deep, unless he had been driven on by the flames of suffering, enlightenment would have been hard to develop. When his enlightenment did open up, all the causal bases for enlightening others flowed out from within him. This was the functioning of the primordial Buddha's fruit of enlightenment. I think the thing to take from this is that if we feel that everything is, that we're feeling kind of complacent just drifting in our practice without much incentive or motivation, not much of an aspiration, we can count on that changing when our suffering becomes felt enough. We all have enough suffering, we've experienced enough suffering to bring ourselves to sesshin. That's more than 99.999% of the world. It is our discontent. Let's use a different word. Discontent, or our frustration with something in our life, our relationships, or a number of things in our life. Our dissatisfaction is strong enough to have brought us here. That's a great, great resource that we've tapped into, is this suffering. Still, it may not be enough for us to accomplish much in sesshin. We've got here, but then without the suffering really biting into us, then we can just meander through sesshin, and once we've learned how to work with physical pain and we sort of figured out how this works, well, we can go on sesshin after sesshin, really not breaking through into this matter of suffering and freedom from suffering. But doesn't it seem obvious that sooner or later our suffering will reach a critical mass? And it may not even be in this lifetime, where now we really, really, it's deeply felt, this need. That's what it comes down to, is a need to find a way out of the suffering of the human condition. But first we have to feel that. It has to be, Roshi Kaplow once said, everyone needs meditation. But not everyone feels. It's not a felt need for everyone. When it becomes really felt, when we, especially if it's felt to the point where we're desperate to free ourselves from the human condition, then stunning things can happen. And until then, to do our best, to work as hard as we can, is all preparation for when we do are given a diagnosis of a terminal illness, or someone very close to us dies, or we suffer some other kind of loss. Then we're in a position, having practiced Zen long enough, and especially having gone to Sesshins, where we can really turn that suffering into something completely different, and really liberate ourselves from this round of birth and death that the masters all talk about. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.